Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by the California 1020, 10 miles, 20 bands on February 15th, 2015. That's Del Mar Fairgrounds, Encinitas and back, cal1020.com. Core Sports, the very best in women's athletic wear, coresports.com. And of course, you can check out any of our interviews on iTunes on Babbittville Radio. Our next guest, amazing, amazing young man. His book is called The Hurt Artist, My Journey from Suicidal Junkie to Iron Man. Shane Niemeyer joins us. Shane, how are you?
Man, I'm really good. I appreciate you having me on, and I appreciate you guys to listening to us. So I'm good. Thanks.
Not a problem. So you grew up, I grew up in Illinois as well, so you were in Bloomington?
Yeah, that's right. In Bloomington Normal, basically, yeah.
And so did you have any sports growing up?
No, I didn't play any sports anyway growing up.
You just, but you started drinking pretty young.
Yeah, I think so. So the lack of one probably contributed to the other. having the virtue of hindsight.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that, because I was probably, I was pretty tightly wound kid, anxious and high energy. And when I was transplanted to Central Illinois, I think, trying to fit in with a new peer group, I suppose. And the combination of that and just a change of environment kind of contributed to my delinquency. You know what I mean? Ultimately it was my fault, but.
So where did you say, when you change of scenery, where did you start out?
We started out in Loveland, Colorado.
Okay.
So I was in Loveland, Colorado, and then at the age of eight or nine, we moved to Southern California. So in Loveland, I was, in Colorado, I was in the mountains all the time as a kid, and then I was at the ocean all the time through junior high, and then we moved my eighth grade year, really, and which is kind of a formative time, I suppose. I mean, I've had the opportunity to kind of look back across time, the arc of time, and that's kind of the contributing factors. And then I was kind of plucked out of Southern California, and we found myself in Bloomington, Illinois, where I didn't know anyone. And
yeah.
And it was kind of a, right smack dab in my adolescence. And the wheels came off pretty quickly.
I was going to say, because from the obviously, you're a hyper guy. The fact that you get into Iron Man and you're one of those guys who has a focus when you set a goal and you go after it. But when you're in Bloomington, Illinois, it doesn't sound like you had that. It seemed like you were just sort of scattered and didn't know what to do.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, that's kind of the narrative that I've framed it up with.
Yeah.
There were signs, and in elementary school I had trouble sitting still. You know what I mean? I was pretty kinetic, and my parents got a lot of calls from teachers and principals. But and as I got older, that the behavior just kind of progressed, and I didn't have anything to channel that energy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So you kind of hit the nail on the head, Bob.
So I think. By 18, you've been arrested for theft, burglary, driving under the influence. Was there a point where were your parents getting frustrated with you?
Yeah, I mean, really early on, they were. As parents,
yeah,
they tried to intervene. But you're at this point, I'm 12 and 13, they have a little more jurisdiction. When you become 14, 15, and 16, you can't lock me in the house. And my behavior became increasingly erratic, and I guess, again, I have the benefit of hindsight, and I read a lot.
Right.
So I've kind of been able to frame things up, and I deal with a lot of, grown-ups and adolescents at times that have similar issues. But, they were alarmed. And my behavior, to be quite candid, was, there were times where I would threaten my mom, threaten my brother.
Oh, wow.
I was drinking, and, there was guns in the house. My father was a hunter, and they were alarmed. So initially, obviously the consequences in our society, they start in school. In our kind of social environment. So consequences for me started at school. And then they obviously, really began at home, bled over into school. And then my parents had, they took me to the first kind of intervention was a psych unit because they didn't know what to do with me. They feared that I was going to And now, you know, however many years, really 20 years later, that kind of behavior today would be very alarming, right? Because
of
all the school shootings that we've seen. And I would say, I mean, I don't, my intentions were never really to hurt anyone, but you never know.
Right.
And so my parents, they you know, I went to a psych unit and was with some very troubled adolescents for a month. It was locked. It was that was a pretty extreme experience. And then I got out and I had changed for a little while, but I think a problem with a lot of treatment centers or psych units is they're trying to address the problem. So the kind of ideology is regressive, right? We're looking at what's wrong, which is important. But we never really looked ahead, and I never really began to develop a concept of, okay, there's a lot of things that are wrong, but what do I want?
And what's the
solution?
You know,
there was no forethought, no forward thinking, no. And now that's a pretty big, you know, with Marty Siegelman, who's basically the father of positive psychology. I mean, I have to kind of disagree with that approach in that, you know, now when I'm, you know, I just end up getting phone calls because I have this small platform now. And, and a big part of it is, so if you're drinking too much, obviously you need to remove that behavior, but that's going to create a vacuum unless we develop a concept of who we want to become or an ideology, you know, an idea of where we're headed, the things that we enjoy, this kind of concept of an ideal self, then I believe we're kind of stuck in this cyclical patterning. It started with that psych unit, and then after that, I mean, things just got worse because you become closer to an adult, and then you're basically in and out of jail then at this point. You know?
Well, yeah. So Colorado State, you're suspended in 97 for inciting a riot. That's
right,
always nice, right?
That was crazy.
Yeah, Boise.
Crazy.
Now, did you feel angry a lot, or did you find that, you know, when you were drinking and doing drugs, you felt better about yourself? Are you able to look back on it now and go, I wonder why I was doing all that?
I think... Right, and it's easy now. I'm much more in touch with, you know, what's going on because the average, it's been established. The UCLA's lab for neuroimaging is, and this study's been replicated. Basically, we have 70,000 thoughts a day. Most of them we're unaware of. They're subliminal, but they're constantly influencing us. They're constantly influencing our behavior, our conscious mind. So I think, you know, looking back, I was angry. I was probably more confused, but anger seems to be like a secondary kind of emotion. I was afraid that I wasn't going to fit in with this new peer group. I was afraid that I wasn't going to like Illinois. I was afraid that I didn't have control over my life. I really had a lot of animosity towards my parents for plucking me out of an environment which I liked. And so in order to kind of try to regain some control over that, this kind of internal turmoil that I had, the first couple times I drank, obviously you already have the adolescence working against you. For some adolescents, particularly today, it's kind of a confusing, tumultuous time and trying to fit in with this new peer group. And obviously drinking becomes a conduit through high school and it's a rite of passage. And for me, it really washed away and quieted all that noise in my head and all this anger and anxiety. But, you know, when you pour alcohol or drugs on top of that, you magnify the behavior. So the environment, you know, I'm acting out, I'm behaving in a way that's erratic, and you're getting pushback from the environment. So you've got this, what Albert Bandura calls this kind of a reciprocal determinism. You know, I'm acting out at school, I'm acting like an idiot, not showing up late to class, so there's consequences. I'm acting like an idiot at home, so there's consequences. So then I drink more to kind of, quiet my mind and try to forget the consequences, and it just kind of really got away from me pretty quickly. And then that combined with this, for whatever reason, you know, I didn't have many boundaries. You know, still to this day, a lot of people that I know who drink too much, they create boundaries, right? I won't drink during the day, I won't drink and drive, and they're pretty much able to stick to them. But by the time I was 18 and 19, those boundaries,
you didn't have any
pretty
of
much. Yeah, it was gone. Yeah, and it was crazy, Bob. Looking back on it, the way my life is now, it really is. I can't believe it happened.
Well, it's funny because I bet you look back at the younger Shane and go, "Man, how did that happen?" It's almost like a different person.
I'm telling you what, buddy, it is. And what's weird, because you know, and a lot of my peers at that time, a lot of them are dead.
Right.
And I was the craziest of all of them, and here I am, I'm thriving, right? I'm married to this, probably one of the most, I mean, easily one of the most beautiful women I've ever known. She's a professional triathlete. I have, you know, have a very fulfilling kind of career and environment with the people I work with, and we live in Boulder, which is a beautiful place, and we kind of do whatever we want, and it's hard to imagine that I made it out of that, and not only did I make it out of it, that I've found a way to kind of thrive in spite of it all, where so many today and back then, and I think today it seems a little worse. I mean, it seems like there's a huge heroin epidemic throughout the country, methamphetamine, new designer drugs. 70% of our population is overweight, and I think it's a symptom. It's a different symptom of the same disease, right? It's this discontent that a lot of people, I would say the majority of Americans have, really. I mean, if you're obese, my contention is that you can't really be fulfilled because you're, you know, who you are as a person is enveloped or embodied in this biological entity. And when you're obese, that biological system is not healthy, and therefore you have to operate at a lower level. And obviously the same is true with alcoholics and drug addicts. And when we have right now 42 million Americans are on an antidepressant, and obviously they're necessary for a segment of that population, but it's been pretty well established through Irving Kirsch and other behavioral scientists that the main category of those antidepressants don't work. You know, I was a victim to that kind of same undercurrent of discontent, you know, I guess. So it is kind of really, it's forced me to examine it from multiple perspectives, you know what I mean, Bob? It's just
I do.
Kind of blows my mind, really.
What's interesting to me is, and you've gone through probably more therapy than most people out there, during that time, did any of those guys ever say, you know, maybe you should get into sport? Did they ever prescribe and say, why don't you, let's get you a bike, let's get you running, let's get you, because it's funny,
man.
I don't think there's a better solution than endorphins. And we see it with our Challenge Athletes Foundation. When your military guy comes back and he's missing a leg and missing an arm and his whole life is about his physicality, it's like, you've got to get him back into sport. You've got to get him back into being physical, because otherwise you just spiral out of control with all the negative thoughts.
You know, that is one thing, particularly with our young men and women who have served our country. To answer your question, I guess,
they never did.
No, and I can't believe it. And that really led me down this road to, you know, I really became very, particularly in prison, I became very thirsty. Why do we do what we do? And, you know, how does the whole human condition work? And certainly for me, and it's obvious now, a bunch of research has borne out, but the behavioral scientists that I interacted with then, and it's still to this day, the largest kind of paradigm that they're operating from is, you know, regressive forms of psychotherapy.
Yeah.
You know, there's some new forms of like motivational interviewing, but still, if you're not exercising,
that's a
critical component to we're trapped inside of these bodies. And largely, you know, hell, we get it. You totally get it. And so does a lot of your audience, but it is probably the biggest gap, I think, in just basically all of, you know, medicine and behavioral science is using exercise as medicine, because
exactly.
It is, in so many ways, the best form of medicine we have. And
no question.
And that's a really interesting point about those challenged athletes.
It's important.
God bless every single one of those guys, man. I'm glad you spent some time with those guys.
Yeah. Well, so in Boise, you're convicted of burglary. So now it goes from, you know, misdemeanor stuff to, you know, drug possession, the first felonies. Now you're in prison. You could be serving up to 10 years. When did you get to the point where you felt like, you know what, this is, it's check, please, I'm out of here. This is, it's just not, I need to, you know, to cut the cord here.
You know, it's crazy. So at that, that time in Boise, which is important to mention, a lot of times people, we kind of rail on the criminal justice system.
Yeah.
But In regards to, we have so many people locked up in this country per capita. We have more than China and Russia combined, is a statistic you hear a lot. We have 2.2 million people locked up. My experience, it's important to mention, I was given every single opportunity that I should have never had. I've got, 15, 20 plus chances, and finally I started catching some more serious cases, and by that time, I had been exhausted for a long time. I had been resigned to the fact that at some point, I remember thinking very fatalistically that because my behavior was so erratic and I was overdosing pretty frequently, and when I couldn't get my hands on a firearm to rob a drug dealer, when I couldn't get enough money, I was running around with a meat cleaver and robbing these guys.
Oh, my God.
And I figured for sure that I just knew that by the time I wasn't going to live past 30, and that I was going to go out with an overdose. One of those guys would kill me,
sure.
And they had come close. You know, I got ran over. I've been stabbed. But none of that happened, and instead what ended up happening is I just kept coming through. So at this time, and when I got locked up, the last time, and I knew I was going to do some time, and that wasn't the issue. The issue was that I was so afraid that I couldn't change. I was so afraid that my life, that here's where I'm here. I'm now at this point almost 28, 29 years old.
Yeah.
And I have nothing. I'm homeless. I'm totally strung out. My family's not talking to me. I have no friends. And this is what my life is. And I'm never going to be able to recover. There's no way I'm ever going to, I couldn't pull it together. I'd been in and out of rehabs and institutions. And so I'm in a state of utter despair, which is the absence of hope. And when there's no hope, I don't know. I mean, I think through these things, and certainly it was the single saddest moment in my life, because I knew that if I can't stop engaging in the behavior that keeps putting me in this place, because I'm responsible for being here. I'm right where I belong. I'm in prison, and this is what prison is for. It's for people like me, and this is where I belong. But if I can't change, I'm just doomed to repeat this, then at least I can, in my convoluted kind of mixed state of mind, obviously I'm withdrawing from drugs and I'm very kind of in this state of desperation and despair, I decided that I was going to exhibit one last act of self-control, and that if I can't stop my behavior, at least I can stop my bodily function and hang myself. And that's kind of what I set out to do. And I called my mom, and I hadn't spoken to her for a long time, and I didn't have the guts to talk to my dad. So I told her to tell my dad and my brother that I was sorry, that I was such trash, and that it's not how they raised me. And I was just basically really sorry for everything. And I hung up the phone and I waited for lights out. I had managed to surreptitiously kind of smuggle away this extension cord. We all know what those orange extension cords that was attached to one of those backpack vacuums you'll see custodians using.
Right.
And I ripped it off and hid it. And at when the guards change shifts in the Ada County Jail, there was a pocket on this top tier that I could hang myself from, and that's what I set out to do. And I remember when I jumped, the intensity that experience is something that always haunts me. And it's one thing, speaking about, a lot of our service members come home and they end up committing suicide. A lot of adolescents commit suicide, and in so many ways, because of that moment, when I jumped off, I remember thinking about this girl in high school that I went to school with, and she had hung herself, and we all talked so callously about her weakness and her lack of character, and that's a form of natural selection. As right before I jumped, I remember thinking that I was so wrong, that we had our heads so far
up somewhere.
We had no clue.
Yeah,
right. And we had no clue, and she felt just like I did right now, that I'm looking forward to dying and ending it. And so I jumped, and then when I kind of regained my awareness, I was, in this medical unit at the Ada County Jail, and I had separated a couple of my cervical vertebrae and probably broke my foot. At least we never got it x-rayed. They don't give you the best medical care, at least at that time. And so, which was fine, and that was an experience, again, which is very hard to look back on. And still, because it imprinted me in such a profound way, having come through that, slowly, like what that despair was replaced by the sense of hope and gratitude that I did come through it, and then I was in a very powerful position at that point from then on.
So that was a turning point when you tried commit. Here you are at your lowest ebb, at your lowest point. You're going to commit suicide, and the suicide's unsuccessful. So you sort of failed at suicide. But
utter failure. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But now that you wake up and you go, okay, I'm alive. And was the thought, I've got another chance here, and I'm going to take advantage of it? When did you read the, it was an Outside Magazine article on Dave Scott.
Yeah. So that was, it was within a day or two.
Yeah.
And, on the one hand, and there's a lot of research, Harvard's got an institute that there's a lot of science this way, that if someone makes it through a suicidal crisis, that's why it's very difficult when someone has access to a firearm, because that's usually pretty lethal.
Yeah.
You can make an error when you hang yourself or overdose. But there's a lot of research that bears this out, that if someone makes it through that, a suicidal crisis, the likelihood of them going through it again is much lower. And so that was my the way I felt was, yeah, this emerging, obviously at first I was so dejected and I was so sad and I was so spun out of my skull from the whole experience, the intensity of the experience, that I was just trying to get my bearings. And then as the moments kind of progressed, I had this opportunity to change everything, because you have no fear.
Yeah,
so
right.
You're not afraid of anything. You just tried to kill yourself. And so when there's no fear and you have nothing to lose, I don't care how people look at me. I don't care how much time I do. If I can use the time to the best of my ability, I can change everything. But I didn't know what that was going to look like. And so that article that you mentioned, Bob, about with Dave and Iron Man, and it gave me this kind of sense of an ideal, right, for the first time ever, this sense of like, God, these guys are, that's insane, right? I'm thinking to myself, these guys, you know, they swim 4,000 meters and then they ride 112 miles and then they run a marathon.
Yeah.
And then only like 2% of them qualify for this race in Kona. And I wasn't thinking about that. I was just thinking, what if? So no longer why me or, but no, it was what if, or
what,
you know,
if?
What
can
what
I do I, it? Exactly.
That's right. And what if that becomes, because that, to me, it just, the whole, just the activity of Iron Man and the distances indicates to me that someone who engages in that behavior is a kind of like a heroic, you know, I just kind of developed this archetype in my head, like these guys are crazy.
Yeah.
That's insane. And they've got to be so dedicated and so rigid in the way that they conduct themselves. And I just figured, what if I just started training whenever I can and just try to finish one of these? You know what I mean? Because that's going to keep me out of trouble, and it's just crazy enough to swing the pendulum the other way. It just occurred to me that I can't just stop doing something that I engage of. If I'm awake during the day, I'm getting high and drinking all day.
Right.
So I need something to grasp onto, and it just came in the form of that. And it also seemed to me, like what you said, Bob, is, it just seemed to me that I needed to take care of my body, because I'm fat, but it's totally toxic.
Right.
And I've got it, that starts there, because it, you know, just by the virtue of exercising, you're achieving, you're accomplishing, you're producing a set amount of repetitions or exercise, and it, so just by virtue of just doing some push-ups and sit-ups in the beginning was for me the first achievement that I had had in, you know, a decade.
Forever. So yeah. All of a sudden you're having little successes, which
that's
is
right.
And you would have been having no successes in anything.
Yeah.
After
and
20,
you know how
yeah.
it is. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right, Bob. And it's linear. The progress is almost, for a long time,
yes,
it's linear. You just keep getting stronger and better, and your body starts changing. And for me, it was really transformative. It was, yeah, I was very fortunate. I've been very lucky, pal.
Well, it gets you, structure. You have to be consistent, persistent.
That's right.
First race, and so here you're a homeless guy, right? And everybody's gone through something like this. Usually has somebody who's a champion for them. And I was reading something. Was it this district court judge Thomas Neville? Was he, yeah, Thomas, was he the guy who basically believed in you when you didn't believe in you?
Yeah, so you know, he gave me a carrot, and the carrot was that here, I'm giving you a 10-year sentence and a 7-year sentence, but if you do this program in prison, I'm gonna you know, let you out early. I didn't know what that meant, 3 years or 4 years, and it ended up being 14 months, and he gave me a pretty good speech. And I also had a Judge Neville,
yeah,
and my who just passed away, actually, almost 4 weeks ago, my very good friend Brett Fox, who was my criminal defense attorney, who he was the only guy that visited me. And when I got out of prison and I didn't have anything to no personal belongings, he let me sleep on his couch as a criminal defense attorney, and I worked jobs washing dishes and riding a bike everywhere. And so it really did. Those were two very and big inflection points for me to have, you know, someone just something, some reinforcement that was external. You know what I mean? It was a big deal, man.
Then you go to a bike shop, and here you are, homeless guy with, I'm sure, not a lot of dollars and a prison record, going, hey, can you help me out? I'd like to get a bike here. You know, so that's always, I'm sure, an easy transaction to make happen. It's like, hey, listen, I'm a homeless guy, and normally I'd be in a bike shop to steal what you have so I can go buy some heroin. But I'd like to get one of these things with wheels on it instead.
Right.
But they supported you.
Yeah, so that was really kind of those guys. Yeah, and so in the beginning, I remember how much different I was.
Yeah.
Because I would, you know, I was almost oversharing a lot. You know what I mean? I had this whole kind of persona of being very humble and really leveling with people. And so I was very honest with them, and they really gave me, they basically gave me the bike on the come, you know what I mean? And,
sure.
And they really took a chance. And for the next 3 or 4 years in Boise, those guys really helped me out. And that was probably, again, another inflection point. And it speaks to this notion that I've had, and there's a lot of research that bears this out, that you know, the things that we do when you think people aren't looking, they seemingly enter this kind of the most innocuous kind of interactions we have can somehow impact people in ways that you could never know. And still to this day, I'll probably get off the phone now and shoot one of those guys a text and tell them thank you. You know
exactly
what I mean? And
yeah.
So it was a big deal. Yeah. So everywhere I turned, you know, where that really got me, and then I started collecting these kind of this peer group and mentors as I went along. That was much, much different than the kind of interactions I had with anyone ever. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So
yeah, I just got really, really lucky that way.
First race, Pacific Crest Tri, Bend?
Yeah.
2005.
Right.
And did you really go 5:08 in your first race?
It was something like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's very impressive.
I got lucky, pal.
No,
and,
you don't get lucky in triathlon. That's the thing about the sport. You put in the work and you get the results, but there's no luck involved. You have to, you know, swim, you know, 1.2, ride 56, and run a half marathon. There's no luck involved.
Yeah, back then I was, you know, obviously I was able to, I had a lot of mental fortitude and a lot of hunger that I think a lot of people probably have never had, you know, because it was something I really needed to do. But,
right.
But I do remember in that race, I didn't know that I didn't know anything about cramping, and now I experienced little cramps, but nothing like I did that day. I mean, I thought I was ripping every structure in my body away from the bone. And I remember thinking, like, halfway through that run, that I don't know how I'll ever finish an Ironman. I kind of went to this dark place, and I don't know how am I ever going to do it, and it was just so demoralizing. But when I crossed the finish line, it was a huge deal for me, man.
When you came across that finish line, were you thinking, where has this been all my life?
Oh, you have, yeah. It was this kind of intense sense of satisfaction. And really, I started crying like a little.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
it was
I don't
a
blame
huge
it
deal for me.
Absolutely.
And it was because it signified all these kind of demons that I had overcome and all these challenges and you know, when I traveled to Oregon, I had to get a letter from my parole officer and find a ride. You know what I mean?
Sure.
It was crazy.
It wasn't easy.
It was crazy, man.
Yeah.
And it was a great deal. And then, so that, in that way, the triathlon has been immeasurably good to me. Just for all the reasons that you enumerated earlier, the structure, just the focus,
right,
the discipline that it provided me. Yeah, man. I've been very fortunate all my since those days.
So what I love is, you know, here you are reading this article. And were you actually in a straitjacket when you read that article?
So what they call it,
restraints?
What they call it is a security blanket, right?
Security blanket. Not like the rest of us, you. It's a special one
right.
for you, yeah.
So it's basically this indestructible garment in a single cell with, you know, obviously no sheets. And the what is made of Kevlar is the small mattress and the small pillow you get, and that's it. So that's what you got.
And so you were in that thing reading this article on Dave Scott in Outside Magazine. And then next thing you know, you're in Boulder and Dave Scott's on the pool deck?
Yeah. I don't remember when I even met. Yeah. Dave, that's where I first met Dave. Yeah. I went to one of his masters and,
Did you go up to him and go, "Hey, Dave, you know what?" Because I'm sure he's heard it all the time. "Hey, I read the article or I saw you on TV. Listen, I was in a restraint in prison when I read an article about you."
I don't remember. I know Dave found out about it because I got to know Dave pretty well.
Yeah.
But I never, I just kind of kept that one to myself. And as I know he's, obviously he knows now.
Sure.
But that's just, like, you know, for especially for people like Dave or Sebastian or Craig and Leanne DeCave and Rennie, they're models of conduct in ways that the good ones truly understand, right? And they conduct themselves accordingly because they become archetypes for people to kind of model themselves after.
Absolutely.
And that's what Dave kind of provided me. You know, he was like the godfather of Ironman back in the day.
No question.
I was.
So where did you qualify for Kona?
The first time I qualified was at Ironman Wisconsin, and it was on the heels of several, I could have got a couple roll-down slots that year, but I just didn't want to do it.
You want to earn it.
There's nothing wrong with a roll-down slot, but for me personally, it was this thing that I needed to just see.
Yeah.
If I could just do it on my own 2 feet and get in the right way. So that year I passed up 2 roll downs because I just kept coming so close. And with Ironman Wisconsin, I think it was 2009, I had a good day. And it was the first time that I realized that if you just keep going, even if you're throwing up or cramping and you can solve the problem, which is a lesson that recently I've forgotten.
Yeah.
If you just keep going and pushing, and that's what Ironman, and that's what life is about. Just you've got to keep moving forward.
Stopping doesn't do anything for you. Yeah, no.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right, Bob. And and I just kept pushing through. And at the end of the day, I mean, I did. I had a pretty good day. I was like, 18th or 19th overall, and for me, that was a big deal. And I was second in my age group, and that was also a big deal. And it ushered in this kind of. You know, I qualified the next 4 years.
What I love is I was watching some of the coverage of you at World Championships, and you're talking to the camera going, "Yeah, I'm cramping, and, you know, it's really tough, it's really hard." Meanwhile, you're going by people like they're parked. You're running by people like they're standing still, and in your mind, you're thinking, "I'm not really having a great day." But
yeah,
you were having a great day.
And that's always, and I've always had a hard, one of my biggest challenges is using the proper perspective. It was, again, it has been a very great, it's a great thing. Triathlon has been a great thing for me. It's been really good to me, and I've been just really fortunate. You know, I'm sitting here talking to you, and you've got listeners out there, and
So you've been the Ironman World Championship 4 times, and the goal is this year you want to get back, right? Is it Ironman Texas, one of the events you're looking
at? So what's interesting, this coming year, if I race Ironman, it will be Ironman Texas. I was really hard on myself this past season. And it was the first year I crashed in Boulder and broke my elbow, and then I kept just kind of chasing it. So, but what's interesting is I got a call from a casting company about perhaps a new show on a major network. So,
we'll see
what shakes out with that.
Love
Obviously,
it.
It's a long shot, but you never know. So, I kind of tweaked my training a little bit to get in more kind of a full athletic, more athleticism into the system.
Right.
I could go into a show like that and we're very fit, but maybe not very athletic. You know how that goes.
Exactly.
So, but yeah, so if that doesn't shake out, then I will definitely, I want to go under 9 hours somewhere.
Wow.
Before I give it a rest. So that'll involve some cherry picking, but Texas could be a good course to do that on.
Are you coaching as well?
Yeah. So, Bob, I'm a strength and conditioning coach.
Uh-huh.
So I work a little bit in the gym, and I do, I've got a lot of clients who are not even really athletes. I've got a YouTube library that I just keep adding strength and conditioning exercises to, and a lot of my guys travel, and I just organize their strength and conditioning protocols. You know, some of them just run a little bit, they ride bikes a little bit, and some of them are, some of my athletes are triathletes and runners. So I do, that's primarily what I do, I would say, right now, and speaking.
So what's the other side of this is, you know, I'm sure that you get calls from parents who've got children most parents, their kids screw up once, they screw up twice, they screw up three times, they put up with it. Then there's a point. There's a if it happens again, we're out, right? And you're sort of the example of, hey, don't give up because you never know. It could be you were in jail 25 times. And
yeah.
Before you turned it around. So what is your message to these parents who I'm sure come to you so frustrated, wondering if there's any hope at all?
Boy, it's true. And I do get those calls, and I feel very fortunate to get those calls from all kinds, from all walks of life, you know. I've gotten those calls from some Ivy League schools where students are struggling, and then some where their kids have dropped out of high school, and the message always is different, but it's similar. And sometimes I feel like it's redundant, but part of the issue is just obviously exercise. You know, I hate to have that be my hammer that I'm using on every nail.
But it works.
Exercise, it is. I mean, the body of evidence is irrefutable that way. And also, I believe that this concept of formulating. Not focusing, we got to focus on what's broken, but what's next? Imagine the development of this sense of ideal. What are you going to become? What are you doing? I mean, if you keep down this road, what lies ahead? But if we tweak this a little bit and we make some changes and you start formulating a plan or just a concept, because most of the time, a lot of these kids, they can't articulate. In 2 years, if you could do anything you want to do, what would you be doing? And a lot of times, and certainly in prison, there's a lot. I mean, that's a vacuum. People cannot answer that question. It's as if they're unable to articulate that the sense of who they want to become. And I think it's a really important kind of concept. So exercise, developing kind of new thoughts and new behaviors to go in line with them, but they've got to revolve around some kind of desired outcome. You know what I mean? The kind of kind of person and the meaning that they're going to attach in their life. I know that sounds kind of deep and philosophical, but I really believe, you know, that there's always hope. There's always hope.
There is always
hope.
But
what's wrong is always, it is always available, but so is the things that we can achieve, so are the things that we can do, so are the possibilities. The possibilities are as available as everything that's wrong. And we need to start focusing a little bit on those possibilities and really kind of fleshing them out and giving them giving them a better definition.
Shane, when you it was one thing to finish other Ironman races, but when you finished Kona for the first time, that was the event you read about in Outside Magazine. That was sort of reading that article was the beginning of recreating your life. What did it mean to you to come across that finish line?
Oh, buddy, I got that meant a lot to me because my old man and I had our differences.
Yeah.
I just wanted him to see me make it to Kona, which he did, but he never made it. You know, he died 4 months before the race, and so it was a really heavy
yeah.
thing for me. All around, it was the first year Mandy and I had been together, so it was as if one door shut but the other one opened, and so Mandy was with me, my dad wasn't there, and it was the first year I made it to Kona, and I get the sense that there's still this narrative in my head that maybe I made it here by accident, maybe I don't belong, but so it was, what crossing that finish line was, it was the most, up until that point, the third most intense experience I had
yeah.
ever. Besides my suicide attempt and my father's passing, that was right up there as this. I rode down that cloud for a long time afterwards, and it was a very satisfying experience. And it wasn't just the race, it was just who I had become, right?
Yes, you were a different person. Yeah.
A completely different person with now a pretty well-defined and clear road ahead of me. I even understood from the outset that I'm going to have to look past Ironman because one day it's going to be gone. And then what? You're left holding the bag. It's much more important who you're becoming and the kind of contributions you're making and the person that you're projecting, how you're interacting with people. Who are you besides that? And Ironman really put me on that path. And that first World Championships was the culmination of all that.
So
it was great, man.
When did, was there a point, you're out of prison and you're starting to go down the straight and narrow and training and doing the first race. When did you reconnect with your folks and for them to know that, okay, you did come out the other end?
Yeah. So there was a lot of trepidation on their, they started talking to me when I was in prison. And my mom would send me books but obviously they're very skeptical as they should be.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Because they've heard that story a million times. And not only that, I was unwilling. I was pretty adamant about staying in Boise, the place where the wheels had come off.
Yeah.
I wanted to be able to put myself back together in a place. I didn't want to have to make another geographical change in the hopes that I would change with it. I wanted to be in a town where I unraveled and put it back together. So they were pretty concerned, but as the weeks turned into months, and there was all this talk about Ironman. I know they thought I was crazy. But I pulled it together, and they were there. They came to every Ironman.
Did they? Your parents came to every Ironman. They must have been so proud.
Yeah. So it was a great. For my father and I, I damn near killed my. My mom. My dad told me one time that my mom, she cried herself to sleep every night for like 6 years. Because you're just waiting for the phone call that is going to come.
Right.
And so with that, and as I'm talking about it, I'll call my mom again for like the 100th time and tell her how much I love her. And then I'll use this and think about all the other parents out there right now that are, that are really, they don't know what to do or where to turn. So we don't have a shortage of that in this country. And I know, I've been very fortunate. And some of it's, you make your own luck to a degree, but my family, having them there, and the whole thing, and they kind of rallied around it, the whole, my mom and my dad and my brother would come to these Ironmans, and it was awesome, man.
What a great experience for them to, it sort of goes full circle. Now they've gone through all the crap. And now they get to go through the good stuff, right? They get to see you. They get to see you suffer, but they also get the good part, where you're coming across the finish line, and that's great stuff. Was it hard to write the book? Was it hard to tell the entire story? The hurt artist.
Man, it was. You know what it was, Bob? Is for one, you can't believe that someone's like the agents are contacting me to write a book. I'm like, are you guys kidding me? So that was weird that even people are interested, but with that I kind of thought about, do I really want to do this? What is my intention?
Yes.
Because if my intention is to, the intention must be, if this a book is a platform, even if you only sell two copies, right, that you have to use it in a way that has some utility for those who read it. So I wasn't, the decision to write the book was kind of onerous, but I ultimately decided to go through with it. And we had this, the guy who wrote it, he was extraordinary. But the tough part was, you know, after prison, I just kind of locked that part of my life away and pushed it down. You know, and I wasn't interested in the whys or what happens. I just was interested in the road ahead. But that forced me to pull up a lot of documents from arrest records. It forced me to pull records, you know, documentation from psychiatrists and these psych units and rehab.
Yeah.
And look through all this really very, very painful part of my life that that I wanted to just kind of deny and move on from. And my sessions with Gary, the writer, it was like we'd get done with 2 hours of going through some of this stuff, and I would be pretty spun out for a couple of days. I was just kind of down. It was, oh man, it was intense.
Because you'd put this stuff in the rearview mirror, and so now you've got to regurgitate it all again.
Yeah, but it was also clear on the one hand that when you have the intensity of experiences that I've had, you know, being run over, being in severe car accidents, watching people overdose, things on the streets that I've seen in Chicago, and I mean, there are things that probably do, you know, it's not like, and I would never make the comparison because our men and women who go into service, they do that out of a totally different vein, out of selflessness. What I was doing is, you know, I kind of signed up for what I did, you know, and the trauma that I experienced, but nonetheless, it was probably, you know, and so it was in the end, it was in the final analysis, it was therapeutic, but man, it was tough on me, pal.
I bet it was.
You know what I mean? Like, I didn't want to talk to anyone sometimes, and yeah, I mean, I did want to put it in the rearview mirror, but ultimately, that's not the best way to probably deal with it, you know what I mean? Because sometimes those things come, I had a bit of a hair trigger for the first couple of years I got out of prison, and would throw things at cars and almost get in fist fights with drivers.
When you were riding your bike, you mean? You had that?
Yeah,
oh, like you were the aggro cycling
to get
guy.
Off my bike.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Nice.
So it doesn't give us a good name, and I wasn't a good steward for our population. But yeah, man. In the end, I mean, I got a book deal out of it, and I just, you know, it's good that that I've had some people reach out and be like, man, that was, I'm glad I read that, you know what I mean? And that sounds so cliche, right? It sounds like something you would expect someone to say, but ultimately, I mean, well, all we have when we leave this place is the impressions we've given other people.
Exactly.
And that we're responsible for making the lives, even if it's putting a smile on someone's face, the gas station attendant or the person you walk by in the gym, every interaction we have is contagious. And if I can start tipping those karmic scales the other way, because God knows how much bad karma I had, and start putting some smiles on some people's faces or giving them some hope in any way or encouragement, then that's what I've got to do. And I was lucky. Again, lucky.
Any contact with any of the folks who you knew in prison, or, you know, some guys who knew you as the other Shane, right, from your past life? Any of those guys ever reoccur and go, hey, dude, you motivated me to do it, or going, I cannot believe I saw you on TV doing the Iron Man?
I've had all of that. Unfortunately, my core group of friends, literally, Ryan Smith, Craig, I mean, I could go on this list, but of like 12 of who became really, you know, as good of friends as junkies can be. They're all, you know, a lot of them are dead.
Right.
And others are still in prison. And unfortunately, a lot of people don't change. But the ones who, some of the guys that I thought had it real bad, really pulled it together. And that is just something that's excellent. You know what I mean?
That's so cool.
So that's good. You get the mixed bag, but I've had it all.
I bet you.
You know, I've had some of my peers, parents reach out to me, and it's just crazy, man. The whole thing is always every day almost surreal when I think about it.
You know, it's interesting is we all know guys who, you know, who are the captain of Little League baseball, and they had success early in life and then went down the wrong path later. And it's sort of not so much how it starts, but how it ends up. And, you know, you turn things around, and you're impacting lives for the better now. So I'm sure there's still times where you look back and go, man, I wasted the first 28 years of my life, right?
You know, yeah, sometimes. Yeah. Sometimes I just wonder, like, I definitely, and this sounds also cliche, I wouldn't take much of anything back, any of the experiences, but I do wonder if I would have started in athletics at a younger age,
yeah,
what could I have done?
Absolutely.
If I wasn't so hard on my body, what could I have done?
But, yeah, obviously you have. When just seeing what you've done, I'm like, this guy could have been. He could have swam. He could have ran. He could have ran in high school and college. And his path could have been totally different if he had stayed in California. If he stayed in Colorado, and sort of that outdoor lifestyle had been there. But you know, again, you know, we're all. It's all about our environment, right? And who we're around. And as kids, we're so impressionable. You just never know which direction you're going to go.
That's right. Now, so here I am, man, talking to Bob Babbitt, legend, living legend.
Oh, listen to you, man. You're the living legend. Look what you've done. You're changing lives. That's what it's all about. And more importantly, you're healthy and happy and moving forward. That's great.
Yeah, man, it is good. Life is good, pal. As well as you know that all too well.
Shane, thank you so much for taking time. I appreciate it. It's, you know, the book is called The Hurt Artist. I know it's been out for about a year, but if you have not had a chance to read it, it's Shane's journey from suicidal junkie to Iron Man. It's really a great read. Shane, thanks so much, bud, for taking some time.
Hey, no, the thanks goes all the way to you, Bob. It's been great talking to you. I've always kind of wanted to meet you. Now I can check that one off the bucket list. And thanks to all the listeners out there. It's great to have you guys. Thanks for having me, Bob.
Hey, and if people want to train, they want to find out about your training programs or anything like that, where can they go?
They can. So you can just Google my name, or and maybe more importantly, if anyone out there is struggling or knows someone who's struggling,
yeah,
I just want them to know not to hesitate to reach out, because that's got to be part of my deal now.
Absolutely.
So you can just, ShaneNiemeyer.com, or I've got a website like everyone does.
Of course.
So they could go to just ShaneNiemeyer.com and find me that way.
Love it. Shane Niemeyer has been our guest. Again, we're brought to you by California 1020, 10 miles, 20 bands, February 15, 2015. Del Mar Fairgrounds, Encinitas, and back, Cal1020.com. Core Sports, the very best women's athletic wear, Babbittville Radio. You can check out any of our interviews on iTunes. Hold on, everyone. We will be right back.